This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour this Friday, May 31st. I'm Philip Nice with four of our Philadelphia Trumpet staff writers. Mihailo Zekic joins us from England. Hello, Mihailo.
Hello.
And there in the studio with you is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And here at our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, I'm with Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
This is the Week in Review edition of Trumpet Hour, so we want to fill you in on the most important news, and we'll explain why it's, in fact, the most important news of the week from the four main regions of the globe, all in an hour or less. That's the goal. We'll have an update from Richard Palmer on Europe, then Jeremiah Jacques on Asia, then Andrew Miller on Britain, the United States, and the rest of Anglo-America. But we'll start with a region Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has admonished us to focus on again and again and refocus on: the Middle East. Mihailo Zekic, start us off with an update on the Middle East.
Yes, so yesterday, Benny Gantz, the Israeli, technically opposition politician, but who's in the National Unity Government, his party staged a motion to dissolve the Knesset or dissolve the Israeli parliament. That would basically mean the end of the current government, or at least put in a caretaker position and start new elections in Israel. Whether this actually gets off the ground or not remains to be seen. Gantz's party, he came in with the coalition with Prime Minister Netanyahu after October 7. Netanyahu had a coalition before then, and he has enough pre-October 7 seats to send that down. Some of those coalition partners, however, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, a man we've talked about in this program before, aren't too happy with him. So most people think it's not going to happen, but there is still a little bit of uncertainty. We'll have to see what happens with that. Also, in an Israeli strike in the town of Rafah, about 45 people were killed. There was a big hoo-ha about that, about American weapons and that sort of thing. Israel, for its part, says that it did everything it could to minimize its impact as it moves forward into Rafah. It's already captured a few key areas, including the Philadelphia corridor, which, as many people that have been watching the news know, is the small strip of land that connects Egypt with the Gaza Strip. Also, there's been some news about the floating pier the United States was to deliver aid to Gaza. We've mentioned on the Trumpet before about how this is another attempt for the United States to directly help Hamas through sending them supplies, money, etc. There's been a lot of bad weather that has damaged the pier. And so far, they say they want to repair it, but so far remains inoperable. So that is something we are still watching as well. And then finally, the International Court of Justice, not the ICC that we talked about more recently, but the UN organ that South Africa brought Israel in with some trouble, etc. Before, when they had the ruling, they were a bit wishy-washy. They didn't commit to anything. They recently ruled this week that Israel cannot launch its Rafah operation. Israel, for its part, is ignoring the ruling, as saying they're abiding by international law. And there's not really much the ICJ could do about it. But more and more, we're starting to see these international legal mechanisms to go after Israel in this war in a way that, considering all of the other conflicts around the world, is pretty disproportionate.
It's amazing to me that the International Court of Justice takes this turn, and other organs, as you've said, international bodies, turn against Israel at the time that you would think that a regular human being would be the most sympathetic to Israel. I mean, there still are dozens of kidnapped Israelis in Gaza, presumably in Rafah. I haven't checked that, but we are still in the direct aftermath of one of the most wicked things a people can do to another people. And this is the time that these international bodies are like, no, even now, we still are going to work to isolate the Jewish people. What caught my ear, though, when you were talking there is Benny Gantz making a move to basically open up an internal political fight in Israel in this aftermath with troops still on the ground fighting in Rafah, in Gaza. It shows that the internal unity that Israel had is at least showing some signs of fracture.
Well, interestingly enough, he's not actually leaving the coalition. He's voting to dissolve the government, but he's not actually leaving. He technically doesn't even have a role in the government aside from being on the war cabinet, the three-person group that talks things over. So in a sense, he has one foot out of the government, one foot in the government, and whatever happens, it looks like he's trying to have his cake and eat it too.
And you'd agree that it's an attempt to weaken Prime Minister Netanyahu, wouldn't you say?
Of course.
Right. Exactly, of course. What's the main story out of the Middle East?
Well, on May 27th, the Wall Street Journal, citing anonymous diplomats, claims the Biden White House is pressing Britain and France to back off of attacking Iran for its nuclear program. We talk about the International Atomic Energy Agency on this program a lot, or the IAEA. It's not just a faceless body made up of stuffy bureaucrats in an office in Vienna, like most other organs of the UN. The member states of the UN actually compose a great deal of influence in there, whether it's things like, say, funding, or in this case, actually having a member state board. That board is going to have a meeting in early June, and Britain and France, the two Western European countries that have permanent seats in the UN Security Council, the two with their own nuclear weapons, like the rest of the world, they have a say in how the IAEA is run. They sit on the board. And they were going to launch a censure of Iran, or at least, according to the journal sources, start the process of censuring Iran in this board meeting next month. What exactly does that mean? Not too much. Iran was censured by the IAEA's board in 2022, and that basically, like almost everything the UN creates, except if it's against Israel, basically turned out to be a strongly worded memo that didn't actually accomplish anything. According to the journal sources, for the United States, this is too far. They're pressuring Britain and France to back off of the censure. Not only that, but they're also pressuring other member states of the board to abstain from the vote. And that the U.S., according to what the journal calls anonymous diplomats, they're going to abstain as well. We've talked on this program before about how the United States is undercutting the global effort to stop Iran's nuclear weapons through, say, clandestine sanctions reliefs or turning a blind eye to violations of the JCPOA, this kind of thing. In this case, this particular move is completely unnecessary. If even a censure even happens, it would mean nothing if it followed the precedent of the last censure. As far as the United States is concerned, they could have gone along with it, smiled for the TV cameras, shown the world, look, we're still tough, and keep doing what they're doing with the Ayatollah and with his nuclear cronies, like they've been doing for years. In this case, they don't even want to give the appearance of that. It's almost like a big declaration to the rest of the world, to Britain and France, two countries that, if you think of the other big conflict everyone's concerned with, Ukraine, are these indispensable partners that are helping defend freedom. In this case, the United States doesn't even want to pretend to them. And if it's willing to do this kind of thing, and if diplomats are willing to talk about this kind of thing to the media, even if anonymously, you could be sure that the government isn't too upset about it. If they wanted to squash this, they would have found ways to squash this, or at the very least come out and show where they actually stand kind of thing. But the fact that this is coming out shows basically the facade is off. The Biden administration, really the Obama puppet regime, wants Iran to get a nuclear weapon. And not only does it want to do that, but it doesn't even want to make itself look like it's trying to stop it. And when, what do you think Iran thinks when it sees this kind of thing? The first thing they think is, we have the backing of the U.S. for sure, full steam ahead. Who cares what Britain and France say? And France especially, we also talk on this program about how continental Europe is forming this new power that's getting really angsty about Iran and wants something done about it, especially in terms of nuclear weapons. France and the rest of Europe now can see that the U.S. is not going to be the hero to step in the day. They know where the U.S. stands on this. They're much closer to Iran. They already struggle with problems of radical Islam, arguably a lot more than the United States. This, you could be sure, is going to get them very, very worried.
I like the way that you've underlined the importance of this, because like you said, on the one hand, it's a censure. It's the equivalent of an international strongly worded memo. And yet, if this is true, that the United States behind the scenes is stopping Britain and France from even slapping Iran on the wrist in a nuclear body for its illegal nuclear activities, then that does equate to an open declaration of support for Iran, that it'll protect Iran not only in extreme cases, not only secretly, but more and more openly.
Well, when talking about Iran, I often go to the prophecy in Daniel 11, verse 40, which specifically talks about a Europe and Iran clashing and it morphing into a much bigger conflict. In this case, when we talk about the United States getting involved and what they're doing, there's another prophecy that maybe your longtime listeners might be familiar with, and that's in 2 Kings chapter 14, verses 26 to 27, which speaks of a crisis hitting Israel. Back then, it was literally the kingdom of Israel, but today it's actually speaking of the United States and Britain and some other countries, as Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor-in-chief of our predecessor magazine, proved in his book, The United States and Britain, a prophecy, which we advertise often on this show. But the prophecy specifically says that there's bitter affliction hitting Israel to the point that if it wasn't stopped, the name of Israel will be blotted out from under heaven. What does blotting out the name of a country under heaven look like? Sponsoring a crazy regime to get the most dangerous weapons man has arguably ever invented. A country that has its foundation in jihad and perpetual war with the rest, actively helping them, actively stopping other parties from even, as you said, slapping them on the wrist, is a pretty big way to do that. And rationally, it doesn't make sense. Even if the government is filled with self-serving, budding autocrats, people trying to line their own pockets or et cetera, they'd have to, even if they're acting selfishly to further their own ambitions, they would have to go pretty out of their way to do things like this. It doesn't make any sense unless if you're trying to blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, unless if your sole purpose is absolute destruction. Why is causing all this destruction? What are the spiritual reasons of all this and everything? After all, we cite it in the Bible. It has to do something with the spirit. Well, our current editor-in-chief, Mr. Joe Fleury, wrote a book, or updated a book rather, called America Under Attack, which goes through why the current government is kowtowing to Iran when it doesn't have to, helping Iran, especially with its nuclear weapons, as much as possible, and a lot of other things that maybe a lot of our listeners would be concerned about, like the southern border, like persecution of political opponents, which we'll talk about later today. That book explains that and many other things.
That's America Under Attack by Gerald Fleury, and you also mentioned the United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. Thank you for that update on the Middle East, Mihailo. Mr. Palmer, you've been covering Europe. Give us a rundown of the top stories in Europe.
The Dutch are closer to getting a new prime minister. Dick Schoof is a career bureaucrat. He's never before held political office. He's going to have to mediate disputes among the four-party coalition. People are saying, well, perhaps it doesn't matter too much that he's not had a political office before. He is kind of going to be middle management anyway, just the way that this coalition is running. It's a significant turn in Dutch politics that you have Geert Wilders and this much more right-wing muscular group as part of that government there. But also, that hardly seems a recipe for strong leadership. And I think we could see more turmoil and upheaval in European politics. And if you had France and Azerbaijan having a face-off in the Pacific Ocean on your bingo card for important news stories of 2024... Firstly, why are you playing bingo? But secondly, you win. The New Caledonia is revolting a bit against French rule. There are pretty significant protests that have been going on for a few weeks there. Basically, what is happening, New Caledonia has some important resources. I think there's a lot of nickel, things that people want for the so-called green transition as we make electric cars and things like that. France is tweaking the voting laws so that people that have moved to New Caledonia from France more recently can vote in any independence referendums, making it harder for that country to split away from France. That's led to a whole lot of protests. Azerbaijan is very annoyed with France because France has been siding with Armenia in Azerbaijan's conflict. Azerbaijan has then decided that it's going to get involved in New Caledonia in the Pacific Ocean, despite not being anywhere near that or anywhere near the Pacific Ocean, for that matter. So they're kind of now funding, giving political support to the opposition over there. It's a story that's kind of blown up out of nowhere to become a major issue in France ahead of the run-up to an election. I think it's something that's kind of continuing to push France towards this kind of militarized state. There's a lot of thing. You look at North Africa that's falling apart in France's backyard and now New Caledonia. You know, there are things pushing Europe and then France in particular. It's another pressure on them to militarize. Not a story I was watching for, but one that's still worth knowing about.
Your main story is more along the lines of something we traditionally are watching for. It also has to do with France.
Absolutely. Yes. Much more in line with what we've been looking for this year. French President Emmanuel Macron paid a state visit to Germany from May 26th to 28th. And like several of his outreaches to Germany recently, it's been an uproarious success. The Germans absolutely loved him. It was all over their newspapers. Once again, he kind of gave this speech where he switched in and out of French and German. But yeah, the Germans loved the fact that he came over there and he would spend a couple of minutes speaking in German and then switch to French and coming back to German and that he spoke their language. And this is a big deal. You know, it's kind of easy to think, okay, well, you know, the French president, they must go to Germany all the time. This is actually the last time you had a state visit, like an official state visit here where you have all that kind of level of pageantry was 24 years ago. So that's not an everyday occurrence. And so, but throughout this, there was a joint award. He was awarded the Peace of Westphalia Award or something like that for promoting peace in Europe. He held a joint press conference with the German chancellor. He had all these meetings with the German president. So he's kind of operating at all of these different levels. The biggest part of his trip, though, was when he went to Dresden. This is where he gave the speech. And it's an interesting venue, to say the least. I think Dresden, in Germany's minds, in our minds, is very strongly associated with the firebombing, where the Allies did an enormous amount of damage to that city. And actually, it's a big talking point in German politics, especially on the far right, but really across all of German politics. And there's no denying that Germany suffered horribly in that war, in the same way there's no denying that Palestinians in Gaza are suffering from what is going on in the Middle East. But for you know, Dresden is one of the things that some in Germany will kind of present this new narrative of World War II in which they're victims. Again, in kind of the same way that people will present the Palestinians in Gaza as victims. So they'll talk a lot about Dresden because it was such a moment of suffering. And so Emmanuel Macron went there. And I think that's if you're working to build a Franco-German military alliance. And during his speech, they're also signing all of these different deals about a Franco-German missile agreement. And you're working on creating a Franco-German tank and a new combat system. You're doing all of these things. And then the keynote of your trip is in Dresden. There's some pretty powerful symbolism there. Now, he didn't necessarily dwell too much in that speech on that particular part of the city. He kind of painted Dresden more as a picture of hope. The particular place that he was, it's called the Frauenkirche. So it's this church that was destroyed in 1945. It became an important protest venue in East Germany. I think Helmut Kohl gave an important speech there shortly after reunification. It was rebuilt only after Germany reunified. So that particular building is a symbol of Germany rising from the ashes. And I think that's more of what he drew upon rhetorically in his speech. But a very interesting venue to have at the heart of this critical trip.
And I think it's interesting to tie into something you mentioned there about the far right. I mean, Dresden and Saxony, the state that Dresden is the capital of, is also arguably the biggest stronghold of the AfD, of Germany's current far right movement. And I believe we talked about it on this program earlier this month. We had even several German politicians on the left side of the spectrum attacked in open daylight by supporters of the far right for their policies. So that would be the equivalent of, like, you go back 30 years ago when the Troubles were an issue, say if a French president came and started giving a speech in Gaelic in Belfast. Like,
yes, though to be fair to Emmanuel Macron, because perhaps I'm not very fair to him very often, or the French in general, because I'm British and it's just too fun. But to be fair to Mr. Macron, a significant chunk of his speech was devoted to criticizing the far right, attacking the Alternative for Deutschland. Yeah, he wasn't there giving them support and succor because it's the European elections next week or the week after. And kind of his main rivals are, on a European sense, some of these different far-right parties. So he wasn't there to give his full-throated support to the AfD, though I think it's an important point that he's still trying to appeal to, say, to that opinion, that strand of opinion.
Exactly. That was more of what I was going for, that he went to the heartland and is trying to talk to people that already think that way on don't vote for them. I'm a viable alternative to your concerns and what I'm offering, including this, you know, Germany rising from the ashes is a comparable alternative to what these guys are offering. The fact that you could even make that argument in the first sense, that tells you, in my opinion, quite a lot as to what kind of Europe they're planning on building.
Well, it's certainly a milestone. It's a once in a quarter century state visit, and then with all the pageantry. And then, as you said, Mr. Faulkner, in the context of military agreements and a greater and greater need for military power that's becoming painfully evident every day, the main speech coming in Dresden, a symbol of Germany rising from the ashes and a symbol of what the situation is now. In World War II, Germany had conquered France, and it was Allies who bombed Dresden and many other cities to the ground. It's a new reality, right? Like, to me, it's like this is a symbol of a new reality where Germany is back. Germany has risen from the ashes. And this time, France is wholeheartedly supporting German militarization.
That's a good way of putting it. And it's France enabling and supporting this rise of this new German-led European empire, really, is one of the key reasons why we focus on this. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry had an article, I mean, this is bang up to date, the May-June 2024 Trumpet print, France's Deadly Ignorance About Germany, that really goes through in detail why we're watching this. I mean, it's very much tomorrow's news today, that article. Like, it describes almost every element of the trip. And he goes into the way that France is empowering Germany, but also in the way that France doesn't understand Germany. Because one of the things he talks about there is France kind of being bewildered by Germany's stance on Ukraine, and France is kind of more gung-ho for let's defend Ukraine, let's fight Russia, and Germany is kind of, whoa, 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 no, you know, hold. And you saw that. One of the big things that Mr. Macron did in his press conference with the German chancellor is talk about the need to have weapons that can strike deep within Russia and giving them to Ukraine. And it was, you know, it's meant to be this big symbol of unity. So the German chancellor didn't want to come out and start this big argument, but he was giving these quite clear non-committal. You'd have this big enthusiastic speech from Mr. Macron and basically the diplomatic equivalent of that's nice, moving on, from the German chancellor. So you see that element on display there. And, you know, that article, Mr. Flurry goes through that, well, France is empowering Germany and they don't fully appreciate what they're doing. And that in some ways they're going to be shocked when they see just exactly what they have enabled. He said they'll be utterly shocked. So this rise of Europe, you know, this is, you can go back to everything Herbert W. Armstrong wrote, kind of broadcasting while Germany was still in ruins, while Germany was still kind of flattened like Dresden used to be, saying they're going to rise again, they're going to be a military power, they're going to be a power, a union of European nations, and France is more than likely going to be included in that. And he was making those forecasts while Germany was rubble because of specific Bible prophecies. And that is now what we're seeing fulfilled. Mr. Flurry's article goes through all of those prophecies, shows how Mr. Armstrong forecasted that from the Bible, and then explains why, well, Germany's got different plans for Europe than France does. Germany has plans to use an alliance with Russia to break from the United States and ultimately betray the United States. And France, though they don't fully realize that, is helping that happen. So we can continue to watch and see now France enabling this rise of Germany. We have another article on this trip that will be up on our website, probably on Monday, Franco-German Cooperation on New Heights, that talks about that trip. But then also, I like that has a positive conclusion, talking about how though there is a time that we are going to see cooperation between France and Germany, between these different peoples. And there's going to have to learn some important lessons. There's going to have to be some punishment from God before we can have real cooperation here. But there also is a time when you are going to see these two powers working closely together in a very constructive way, in the way that people would love to see and are aching to see right now.
The first article you mentioned was France's Deadly Ignorance About Germany, the May-June 2024 edition, with that striking cover that has Emmanuel Macron on it. Check that out at thetrumpet.com, France's Deadly Ignorance About Germany. And then check thetrumpet.com regularly, and one of the benefits is that you will see that article that Mr. Palmer just mentioned about France and Germany's cooperation coming up on Monday. That's the Middle East from Mihailo Zekic. That's Europe from Richard Palmer. We have two more sections to bring you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Hello and welcome back to Trumpet Hour, Week in Review. We have covered the Middle East with Mihailo Zekic. We've covered Europe with Richard Palmer. Now we're going to cover Asia with Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, first a story about Hong Kong. If you go back to about 200 years ago, Hong Kong was barely inhabited. It was just a few small fishing villages, a few thousand people. But the British raised their flag there in the 1840s and started developing Hong Kong and governing it with Britain's law-based system. And Hong Kong became a major trade hub. The population exploded. It became actually one of Earth's wealthiest places. Under the British, it was just a model of opulence and rule of law. But in 1997, the British handed Hong Kong over to China. And at that time, the Chinese leadership promised to let Hong Kong remain essentially as it had been under the British, free and largely democratic for at least 50 years. But the Chinese almost immediately started to break that promise. They started chipping away at Hong Kong's freedoms little by little. And then in 2020, they obliterated anything that remained of those freedoms by enacting the National Security Law. This is a vaguely worded law that lets Chinese leaders target anyone who they view as kind of, you know, insufficiently submitted to their ruthless dictatorship. They use it as a legal wrecking ball, really, just to smash into anybody they want to. And this week, 14 Hong Kongers were convicted under this law of trying to subvert the government. So these 14 individuals now face up to life in prison. Basically just for trying to have a say in how their government is run, which the Chinese promised them they could have back in 1997. So this shows just how determined the Chinese Communist Party is to quash all opposition to its power. And it shows that parts of the world where the rule of law prevailed not long ago are now in a dark new era. And then another story here about Japan and the Philippines. Not long ago, there was some serious bad blood between these two nations because of Japan's occupation of the Philippines during World War II. But now these two nations seem to be burying the katana, you could say, or burying the kampilan, if you prefer. In either case, though, Japan and the Philippines are making peace and taking major steps to ally together. This week, they announced plans to form a defense pact, which will let their armed forces train together inside each other's territory. It'll also open the door to military intelligence sharing and basically just clear the way for them to fight as allies. So this is motivated mostly by a fear that both Japan and the Philippines have of China. But whatever the motivation, it's very notable because prophecy tells us to expect Asian nations to band together in the modern day. And most of that is presently happening under Russia and China, but here we see another grouping coming together under Japan. And eventually we expect for these different Asian groupings to all be pulled together. So quite a lot to keep an eye on there.
Right. Back to that conviction of those 14 activists in Hong Kong. I remember that 1997 Philadelphia trumpet and what a big deal we made about that handover of Hong Kong from Britain to the Chinese Communist Party and what a symbol that is of what was, as you gave us the history there, and what is, and an entrance, if you will, to the times of the Gentiles in that sense. You know, now it's happening. What the Hong Kongers feared is now upon them. I hasten to remind you that the conviction rate in a Chinese Communist Party courtroom is 99%. And that's what these people have to face now. What's the main story from Asia?
Yeah, the big story is that all of the sanctions on Russia have not kneecapped its economy as the West had hoped. Instead, they just seem to be pushing Russia and China closer together. So there was an insightful piece about this from Euro Intelligence this week, and it points out that Europe's sanctions on Russia have really been half-hearted. You know, we're told that the sanctions are serious and debilitating, but if you look at the Russian economy today, it's clear that's not the case. The Russian economy today is on a war footing. You know, the leaders have hollowed out much of Russia's ordinary economy to make it one that's focused on military mobilization. And it is true that that's a little bit of an economic sugar high. You could say it's not a great long-term economic strategy, and it wears off eventually as sugar highs do. And it'll probably leave Russia in an even worse situation than before unless it's restructured. You know, we could expect inflation to get much worse, private consumption to slow, wage growth to also slow. So there are some long-term dangers there. But at least at the present time, the Russian economy is humming along. And I'll just read a little bit here from this Euro Intelligence report. It says, "Remember all those Russian economic experts and former oligarchs who have been predicting that Vladimir Putin would run out of money? Well, Russia's GDP growth exceeds expectations and certainly exceeds the GDP growth of European countries. And Russia's budget deficit is falling fast," end quote. So, you know, Russia's weathering the storm far better than most of us expected. And Euro Intelligence points out that this is also driving Russia and China much closer together. Another excerpt from their report says, "Sanctions on both Russia and on China have intensified the China-Russia relationship, which is now the strategically most important two-country relationship in the Eurasian continent," end quote. So there it is. You know, Russia is surviving the sanctions, and the way it's playing out, it's fortifying the Russia-China axis, and that axis means very bad news for the world.
Look, this is an axis that's been growing in the last couple of years. They clearly oppose an American-led dominated world. The Chinese have moved awfully close to the Russians in Ukraine. And the Chinese, while as best I can tell, Andrew, are not providing them arms, they're providing them with the capacity to make arms. And, you know, I think what we live in a world now where all the hopes that you would have great power, coordination, and cooperation are dashed.
That was Richard Haass there, the president emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he lays it out plainly, I think. This Russia-China axis is focused on ending the era of Pax Americana, or the age of comparative peace that we've had thanks to American leadership. And as Russia and China draw closer, that axis is posing more and more of a threat to the global peace.
A Russia-China axis. It's a reality. It's an absolute reality at this point. Everyone can see it, and people are even calling it a Russia-China axis. We have been looking for this.
That's exactly right. Yes, The Trumpet and our forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, we've been warning for decades that Russia and China would have each other's backs and that they would join together to make war. Even when Russia and China hated each other and were openly at war against each other in the late 50s and the early 60s, even then, we still maintained this forecast that they would join forces, and that's because the forecast is founded on Bible prophecy. There are several Bible passages about an Eastern group of nations joining together in the modern era, and one of the main passages is in Ezekiel 38, which actually uses terms that signify Russia specifically as being the main nation in the bloc, and then other names specifically signify China as being the secondary nation. So those are, you know, the passages that guided us to say these two would lay aside their differences and join forces. And now, as you said just a moment ago, it's very plain for everyone to see that this axis is here. Russia and China have each other's backs to a remarkable degree, and it only seems to be getting stronger. We do have an article that goes through the various Bible passages about that. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China.
Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. Have a look at that. Read those Bible passages and see if those do apply. You know, do those passages that were written a long time ago have been preserved for a long time? Is this why they were written? Is this why they were preserved? To show us what's happening in our world today. That's a bold claim to make. The place to start in looking at that is Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. That Russia-China axis is here. So again, that's Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. So thanks for that update, Jeremiah Jacques. We're going to move on to Anglo-America. Andrew Miller, what news?
Yeah, quite a lot of news in Anglo-America this week. At least 22 people died last weekend after several storms swept through Arkansas, Kentucky, Oklahoma, and Texas over the Memorial Day. In Massachusetts, Boston residents are on edge as their new 39-year-old mayor wants to make crimes including shoplifting and disorderly conduct off limits for prosecution. And a little further south from Massachusetts in Manhattan, people are also getting concerned about their legal system for the opposite reason, that the people in Boston are worried that they're actually taking real crimes and decriminalizing them. A lot of people in Manhattan are worried that they're actually taking fake crimes and criminalizing them. And the fact that Donald Trump just yesterday became the first president in United States history to be convicted of a felony. Ulysses S. Grant got a speeding ticket, but that's a misdemeanor, not a felony. So since Ulysses S. Grant, this is actually the first president to be convicted of a crime, and not just a felony, but 34 felonies. And you start digging into this, and it's really just a joke sham of a trial. I'll recommend to our listeners, this isn't going to be my main story today, although I'm going to talk about it for a little bit, that you tune into one of our other radio programs, the Trumpet Daily radio program, to hear our executive director, Mr. Stephen Fleury, give a lot of details about this case. But those who are following it, the New York Times summary of this is Donald J. Trump was convicted on Thursday for falsifying records to cover up a sex scandal that threatened to derail his 2016 presidential campaign. So, and the reason there's 34 felonies is that Trump's lawyer had paid $130,000 in what they call hush money to get someone who was accusing Trump of a sex scandal to keep quiet. That payment was made in 11 installments, and then there were 12 receipts, and then with the Cohen organization, and then 12 with the Trump organization. So there's 34 pieces of paper that say legal expenses instead of hush money. So they're charged, instead of just charging him once for the payment, since it was all to the same person, they're charging him 34 times for these 34 pieces of paper labeled legal expenses to cover up these allegations of a sex scandal. And the just the shocking thing is that Mr. Stephens, I brought it on his Trumpet Daily radio program yesterday, is the judge actually said that, well, to be a felony, you have to falsify business records to cover up the crime. We're not actually saying what the crime was, and different members of the jury can think the crime was different things. We just want to focus in on the cover-up. It's like, so, well, it's not a cover-up if there's not a crime. You need to charge him with this crime. So you're now, we're now in a situation in New York, basically, to put it all in a nutshell, where you can be charged 34 times with a felony for trying to cover up a crime you have not officially been charged with.
We were talking about this earlier, and definitely for all the details, and if you're really interested in President Trump, and definitely check out Trumpet Daily if you haven't already, you'll get much, much more coverage from that show. But we were talking about this on this show, which has a little bit more of an international focus, whether people are following this, whether they're seeing the same things that we're seeing as far as the justice system itself being deconstructed, being burned to the ground in some cases, in an attempt to get this man. Mr. Palmer, you mentioned that people over in Britain are following this as well.
Yeah, this has definitely cut through much more than any of the other kind of Donald Trump stories, court case stories have. So much so, you know, we're in the run-up to an election and politicians were using last night when the news came out over here to bury bad news because they knew the newspapers this morning, no matter what else happened on the election campaign, would be full of first convicted president, et cetera, of a felony, et cetera. So absolutely, that's got attention. And I think also it's gotten more people hanging and saying, oh, hang on a second, something very unjust is going on over here. I mean, I think Donald Trump is not particularly popular, even within the right wing, say, mainstream media over here. I mean, even finding a British equivalent of Fox News is very difficult. But say that kind of thing, mainstream right, certainly mainstream right newspapers, they've generally been pretty anti-Trump, even if they're on the right wing. Whereas this time, you've had a lot of these type of newspapers, you know, people like Andrew Neil, one of the kind of the most respected broadcasters over here in the UK, coming out and saying, this is unjust. This wouldn't have happened if he would have been a Democrat. You know, he's being convicted for filing payments to a lawyer as legal expenses. That's a very odd thing to be going to jail for, or potentially going to jail, all of these kind of things. So I think it is definitely exposed a new audience to what is going on in the United States.
That's very interesting to me. And as I told you before, that's actually something I did not expect, that international audiences, British audiences would not only care, but perceive what's happening there, to perceive that there's something wrong with the American justice system. And that's concerning to not only Americans, but we'll defer to Mr. Stephen Fleury for all the details on that. You said that's actually not your main story for this week.
Yeah, this main story I'm pretty excited about because it's to do with the Twitter files. Now, if you've been watching this program for any length of time, you know that there was a period of several weeks back last year, over about a year ago, where I covered the Twitter files every week right. on this program for like 2 months in a row, at least 2 months in a row. And then they stopped. And they stopped for 344 days. But just last week, they actually started up again. I think this is Twitter Files Part 23, where if you've forgotten what the Twitter files are, when Elon Musk bought Twitter, he obviously bought all the internal documentation that comes with Twitter. So he was actually going back through all the emails between Twitter officials and the government and proving that not only did Twitter have a left-wing bias, but they were actually taking their marching orders from the federal government in a way that is just one of the most egregious violations of the First Amendment in American history. This isn't just, this is a big company that doesn't want to express conservative viewpoints, but this is the federal government basically telling private industry, you cannot allow those viewpoints on your platform. And now the ones I covered last year focused mostly on the State Department and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I think Matt Taibbi said that he compared the relationship between the FBI and Twitter to a master canine relationship, where the FBI was the master, Twitter was the dog, and it just took all its signals from its master. This newest Twitter files, part 23, is from Michael Schellenberger, and it's actually exposing CIA efforts, Central Intelligence Agency efforts, to do the same thing the FBI was doing, which is potentially more concerning because Schellenberger brings out in the beginning part of his Twitter thread that the Central Intelligence Agency is the most famous of the 18 U.S. government agencies that comprise the intelligence community. Unlike the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the law strictly prohibits CIA employees or contractors from spying upon or running clandestine operations against American citizens on U.S. soil. The FBI can spy on you if they get a warrant. The CIA is exclusively for conducting foreign operations. They have no jurisdiction in any way to spy on people domestically. And yet, if you actually go through Schellenberger's, I think it's about a 10-tweet thread. They used to be longer. They used to do 43 threads because now you can do, they're not even called tweets anymore. They're called posts because it's X. Yeah, they've relabeled X. They're X post, X repost. But they've done this long post thing where before it was like you could only write like two or three sentences. So they'd do these like 50 tweet right. threads. Now there's only 10, but like each of them are like have paragraph lengths. But yeah, you can find that on Michael Schellenberg's Twitter account or X account, I guess as it's called now. But he brings up the point here that back in 2020, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey hired a defense contractor named Peter Zatko, who recommended that they, in order to help them censor conservative opinions, that they work with the Alethea Group, which is full of former CIA contractors and also, even more famously, at the time employed Nina Jankowicz. In America, she's better known as Scary Poppins because she was hired for only a month as Joe Biden's Disinformation Governance Board director. Orwell's got to be kicking himself for not thinking up that term.
Right.
It's so much more Orwellian than Ministry of Truth.
Right.
She spent about a month as the Disinformation Governance Board director and then famously did a TikTok video where she was singing supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, but putting in like Republican names that rhyme with it. It's really disturbing.
Can we make that your clip for today?
I almost did and it creeped me out, but it's a... But, you know, Nina Jankowicz, she was working with the Althea Group with a number of former CIA contractors that basically developing artificial intelligence algorithms to help Twitter censor opinions the governments didn't like. Now, Schellenberger points out, he does point out that, like, to date, he doesn't actually have evidence that any active members of the CIA were giving Twitter marching orders like active members of the FBI were getting Twitter marching orders. But he said the number of former CIA contractors in the Althea Group using artificial intelligence algorithms to censor conservative opinions is still concerning. For once, there's debate over whether former CIA is even a thing. It's kind of like if you're a former CIA, like they just have you resign to get around the legal. If your organization does clandestine operations as its reason for existing, then like just having an agent say, oh, I'm former now, so all the stuff that I was legally prohibited from doing before, now I can do while I'm secretly, because that's what I do, still working for the government. I'm sure in the weeks ahead, they'll have some more investigations coming into that as to actually whether any laws were broken. But the important thing for this is that they actually had people trained by the CIA in censoring disinformation using artificial intelligence algorithms to censor opinions the government doesn't want. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, I think he recently did a Trump brief on just the threat artificial intelligence poses towards the election, even talking about how there's a prophecy in Daniel about an end-time leader in Europe who understands dark sentences and saying that artificial intelligence really plays a big role in those dark sentences. These algorithms, they're hard to understand. It takes quite a bit of mental power. The prophesied Antiochus from Daniel understands these dark sentences. And as anyone who's been following this program for a good period of time knows, there's that prophecy in Daniel, there is a spiritual Antiochus in God's church, a political one, Barack Obama, on the American political scene, and then one to come in Europe. And so Barack Obama is the one that set up this FBI and CIA interference with social media. He actually helped author, this is public knowledge, that he helped author Joe Biden's last executive order on artificial intelligence just last year. He's very up to date on artificial intelligence. He's very aware of how artificial intelligence is being used by groups like the Althea Group and the Center for Strategic Dialogue and other groups that are censoring what you watch and read in a way that is going to influence the next election. Nina Jankowicz was very instrumental in the effort to like ban all information about the Hunter Biden laptop till after the election. And the polls indicate, if you trust those sort of things, that like enough Democrats said they would not have voted for Joe Biden if they knew about Hunter's laptop before the election, that just that one act alone of making sure people did not find out about this till after Joe Biden already took the oath of office was enough to make sure that the deep state sponsored candidate got office in America. And in that case, not even through like outright ballot stealing, but just like using psychological operations to influence human behavior to do something they wouldn't otherwise do by withholding vital information before you cast your vote.
Right. And you've referred to the article here, Barack Obama and the Twitter files. You did write on the Twitter files and Barack Obama's involvement there. And the article you've put here in the outline is Barack Obama and the Twitter files. And again, you've got the CIA, allegedly former CIA agents involved in controlling social media, in addition to what we already know about the FBI in control of social media. And whether it's the CIA trying to perhaps successfully involve itself in even the content management system, allegedly, of Twitter, but certainly to influence people, what they know and what they don't know through social media, or whether it's what we were talking about earlier, where it's a justice system that is weak enough and contorted enough and corrupt enough that it can be used as a weapon. This shows America is unstable. America's justice system is unstable. The American population is unstable. As Jeremiah was mentioning earlier, you've got these two sides that are just completely divided against one another. And the institutions, the traditions that America has had and that has strengthened it through lifetimes at this point are not only rotting, but actively being dismantled at this point. And that's something that is going to have an effect on the entire world. That's all the time we have for Trumpet Hour Week in Review this week. Write us at letters@thetrumpet.com. We want to thank Parker Campbell for sound engineering and Isaac Lorenz. And we want to thank you for listening. We'll see you next week on Trumpet Hour Week in Review.